Genesis and chapter 6. You'll recall a couple of months ago we looked at Genesis chapter 4, and we looked specifically at what is often referred to as the first murder. We looked at the situation between Cain and Abel, and where Cain chose to murder his brother because of both his jealousy and also because of his sin in his heart. And indeed, it would be useful to always read through chapter 5. Chose that not to specifically work through chapter 5 this evening. But chapter 5 is really providing us with a lineage from Adam through to Noah. And that lineage is not the firstborn child. It is the child, the son, that was faithful to God. Often people unfortunately misread those things and always assume that it's the firstborn son that is referenced. But what we are to understand from that passage in chapter 5 is the lineage from Adam through his son Seth, the third son, and through all the sons of those fathers who were obedient to God. Their obedience was significant. In Genesis chapter 5, we actually are introduced to a number of individuals, but we think of Methuselah, who was the father of Lamech, and he became the father of Noah. And we find in that passage, in verse 28, that his father, when Noah was born, said, "Out of the ground that the Lord has cursed, this one shall bring us relief from our work and from the painful toil of our hands." Indeed, for whatever reason, Lamech actually knew that Noah was going to be different. He may not have envisaged what that difference was, but he felt that indeed Noah had a very significant place in God's plan. And we come to chapter 6. And we are introduced to the concept that indeed the world at that time was full of sin. There was lots of individuals who were disobeying God in all that they did. But what is significant is what is provided to us first. Indeed, we are introduced to the fact that actually the sons of the sons of God saw the daughters of men. Indeed, there are many people who try to translate this in rather interesting ways. I would suggest the reason is because they don't want to face the reality of what it actually teaches. What is simply understood is normally the simple concept that the Bible teaches us. And what is understood very simply from this is those who were faithful to God, those who claimed to follow him, looked upon the daughters of Cain. And what they saw, they liked. They saw that they were very beautiful, and they desired them. It wasn't that there were no women available to them. It wasn't that there weren't faithful women available to them. But rather, they saw the beauty of those from the line of Cain. And indeed, we understand from Scripture that the line of Cain were in great disobedience to God. And that desire was not only a desire, but they actually went forth and they married those whom they chose. Indeed, the extraction from this is that they saw the beauty of the woman, and they very much appreciated it. And indeed, they may have described that they fell in love. And surely that's what marriage is all about. It's about the fact that we fall in love. And they had diminished the role of marriage. Indeed, we remember back, don't we, to Adam and Eve, in which Eve was made by God out of the side of Adam. And the reason for that was that he was to have an equal. He was to have one who was of significant benefit to him. And indeed, it is the one who God had chosen for him. And that role of that importance of that marriage had been diminished by this time in Genesis chapter 6. No longer were those following God choosing and wanting to see who God had chosen for them. They went after those that they thought were attractive, those who they wanted to fall in love with. And indeed, we find in this passage that it reminds us somewhat of the passage we were looking at Romans last month, in which we found the clear declaration that we are not to be unequally yoked with unbelievers. And then we realize here in Genesis is the first occasion where that is clearly laid out for us, that God sees this and he is greatly dismayed. God cannot accept what is taking place. Indeed, we find also that we are told that their offspring were unique, shall we say. They are referred to in this passage as giants. Whether they were actually giants in stature, we do not know. The translation that is provided to us is based on the assumption of the same word being used in later passages of Scripture, where we know that the race concerned where Goliath had come from were indeed giants. They were 10 feet tall. Whether it is literal that they were also 10 feet tall or not, we do not know. But what we do know is that that word that is used for giants is actually also translated the fallen. Those that have fallen from God's grace. And indeed, they were mighty. They were powerful. They may have been physically very unique compared to all others. The joining of the genetic pool between those of Seth and Cain may have indeed produced very capable men, very strong men, able to fight in unique ways. And indeed, the passage tells us that these men were of great renown. They were the mighty men of old. And what that means is that they were violent. And they were noticed because they were warriors. They were to be feared by those around them. This was not a good thing. This was not glorifying to God in any way. But indeed, they had added to the sinfulness of mankind. They had added to the violence that was taking place. And in Scripture, we know that at this time there was no government, there were no laws. God had not provided any to them. And indeed, mankind shows themselves as being what they are. Mankind, in his and her own way, does not choose rules for themselves. We are told by humanists today that actually we should embrace humanism, because we will establish our own rules and we will do things that are right in our own eyes, and those things will be good. We will create our own laws and we do not need the things of Christianity. And yet the reality is that when left to their own devices, human beings do not create laws. They eradicate laws. They dismiss all rules because they wish to have power. They wish to have what they choose, despite the impact on others. And indeed, we've seen that throughout history. Every time there have been these sort of great nations or these significant nations, or significant powers or leaderships which wish to take power across the globe, these are not individuals who establish rules protecting the rights of people. These have always been the ones where the rules are taken away and men and women are treated terribly. because they wish to have their power and they wish to have what they find pleasing to themselves. And indeed, we find in this passage, in these verses, that what is declared to us is that man's sinfulness has actually come to a position of absolute. They are absolutely sinful. There is a complete disregard for God. There is a complete disregard for what he requires of them. And the sinfulness that they display in their actions are widespread. We cannot even imagine, really, the extent to which those things had come about. We can only envisage that we actually today only see a fraction of what was actually taking place there. There, as I say, there were no laws, there were no rules. Murder was commonplace, and the violence was indeed greatly significant. And we find in this situation that God declares his judgment. We see in this passage, in verse 3, we see that he says, "My spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh. Yet his stays shall be 120 years." Indeed, we look at chapter 5 and we realize that the normal age that human beings were living for were quite extensive. Whether they were as extensive as those who obeyed and followed God, generally, I would suggest not, because of the level of murder that was taking place. People's lives were obviously cut short. But for those who were in obedience with God, they were living approximately 900 years of age. That is a long time. And indeed, they would have seen many things during their lifetimes. But here we have this declaration of that mankind's years shall be 120 years. There are two ways in which this can be translated. One, which is the one we're going to take in a few moments, is that indeed this was the length of time that God was giving to mankind before he brings his judgment to bear. But there is also another one that is purported, which I think is more of a likable contrast in many respects. It's something that sort of almost explains what happens next a little bit. That indeed after the flood, that mankind's age has been limited tremendously. But the problem they have with this is Abraham lived for more than 120 years. So that would not seem to be the actual correct understanding, because with God's word, his word is absolute. So we concentrate on that first understanding, that indeed at this point in time, God is declaring these things. He is announcing that in 120 years, he will bring about the destruction of mankind, the animals, and the planet. And that is a somber time, is it not? And we find, as we look into those following verses, verses 9 to 12, that we are told, and including verse 8, that Noah, over these coming years, found grace in the Lord's eyes. Indeed, we are told in the last verse of chapter 5, and chapter 5, verse 32, after Noah was 500 years old, he fathered Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And we know, and we'll look at this another time, but we know that the flood waters came in the 600th year of Noah. So this declaration that we have seen, that the world was desperately bad, had rejected God, was full of sin, was some 20 years prior to Noah fathering these three sons. And the implication in the following verses are that those things have been presented to Noah, either around the time of the birth of his sons or just prior. And Noah is told specific things. But before we come to that, we note that very significant thing that is mentioned about him. Noah was a just man, perfect in his generations. We are not to misunderstand that. Noah was not sinless. There was no claim that that be the case. But rather that Noah was righteous through his faith in God, and that he endeavored to obey God in all things. And indeed in that, I would suggest that Noah, unlike many others, had actually chosen a wife that feared the Lord. Because those verses prior show that the Lord was significantly unhappy with those who were obeying him, dismissing that premise that God had shown them through Adam and Eve, that indeed they were to have those which were beneficial to them, that the Lord would present to them. And indeed, I would suggest Noah accepted the wife God had chosen for him. We're not told much about her. In many respects, we think of what a significant event these are, and yet we are told very little about Noah's wife. But what we are told about what took place is that Noah did not find favor with men, but rather he found favor with God. Indeed, Matthew Henry, in his commentary, points out that if we look at the world at that time, and we consider the following: take away the conscience and fear of God, and men become beasts and devils to one another. Which is a fair assessment of what was taking place. Indeed, we know that from what I mentioned at the beginning of the service, Methuselah was still alive, Lamech was still alive, and Noah was alive at this time. And they were in obedience to God. But Noah had found particular favor in God's sight as the one he would use to bring about his plans. And yet it must have been incredibly difficult, mustn't it? We think of what it is like today to live life as a Christian in the world around us. And yet the things there were so much worse. It is hard for us, as I say, to truly comprehend the extent to which things had got. But sometimes we are dismayed when there are so few of us here amongst so many around us in the area of London. And yet the numbers of those who followed God at this time were far fewer. And the sinfulness of those around them was far greater. It must have been incredibly a difficult time. And then God says to Noah that he is to build an ark. He is to build an ark. And he gives specific commandments over how that ark is going to be built. He is to build, and that ark, that word ark, means box. He was not asked in that concept to build a ship. In that context, that would have been somewhat not understood by Noah. Indeed, small boats would have existed to go fishing, most likely along the coast. But there was no need for seafaring. Why? Because there was one single landmass. Where were they going to go to? And yet, this single landmass, God has said to Noah, build a very, very big box. And we find that the measurements are given to us in cubits. I would mention to you that there are many different translations that provide a measurement for what a cubit is, but the vast majority of them use the modern understanding of what a cubit is. If you wish to go to Turkey and you wish to go to their main museum of artifacts, you will find in there a cubit measure that is made out of copper. And it has been dated to be from 2650 BC. Now, if that is true, that has very interesting ramifications. It was actually found in the river Euphrates, which is an odd place to find it. But when we consider later on, as we look through things, we will discover the importance of where that is. If we consider that this was found in the river Euphrates, if the date, and I say if, because it's always possible with these dating methods that they have it completely wrong, but if they have actually got it right on this occasion, that would mean that that cubit measure was actually on Noah's Ark, because it predates when the flood actually took place, which was approximately 2350 BC. And so therefore, even if it was actually later, even if it wasn't as old as that, we could probably estimate that it wouldn't be too unreasonable to consider that actually it was either owned by one of Noah's sons or one of his grandsons. Because one of his grandsons was particularly known for his ability to make metal and to use it in interesting ways. And it would seem very sensible that he would have made a cubit measure. All of that, in some sense, is a side aspect, but the actual length of that cubit measure is very important, because it is the closest that we can possibly come to in understanding this passage. It is a cubit measure that is specific to this era. And as such, we can translate the measurements that are provided in here for us to being 510 feet long, 85 feet wide, and 51 feet high. This box was very big. It is huge. And indeed, we can understand that the passage has provided to us that there is to be an opening very close to the top, one cubit from the top, which is a window, that there would be a door on the side of the ark. And from that door, it opens up, obviously, into an area of deck. And we are told that there is to be a lower deck, and a second lower deck, and a third lower deck. Indeed, this is often translated as being three decks, but I think when you actually listen to that very carefully, you suddenly realize that actually there are four decks that are actually mentioned in this passage. Many people draw into question the reality of the ark, because they have a picture of a little boat that can barely fit in any animals. And indeed, a draft seems to overpower that boat and be almost as big as the boat itself. The description here that we have in the Bible is very, very different. If you want to sort of equate things into modern terminologies, you could actually fit two Boeing 747s on the deck. Or you could describe it a different way. You could fit three space shuttles on the deck. It is huge. It is a very, very large box. And I use that phrase very carefully, but we will come back to that at another time. But this evening, I would bring you to think about the significance of what Noah has been asked to do. We will look at another time about the practical aspects, but tonight I want to think about what Noah has been asked to do and what that looks like in our own thinking. Noah is on a land where he is surrounded by people who disregard God's word. He's been asked to build a box. And he is effectively told that he will have sons, and his sons will have daughters, and that they will be safe too. And we find that indeed, from this moment on, he does have three sons, and the whole family work on the construction of this box. It actually takes this family 100 years to build this box. Now, from Noah's point of view, that's quite a short time. He's been alive for 500 years. And so, therefore, it's only a small window. But in comparison to our experiences of life, that is a lifetime. That is more than a lifetime. I would consider myself incredibly fortunate if I was to live 87 years. So, therefore, 100 years is somewhat fantastic, isn't it? It's an amazing period of time. And we know what it's like when we work for one day outside a church building. Maybe we've been clipping some of the weeds. Maybe we're doing some painting. And people walk past. And you almost sense, can't you, the odd looks that you get. And when you walk into church on a Sunday and people look at you and there seems to be a bit of laughter. And you're not quite sure whether they've just happened to hear a joke from somebody else or whether we are the butt of the joke. But we find it hard, don't we? That on a single day basis, Noah built an ark, a huge box in the middle of the land that would have been seen from everywhere. The Bible teaches us that no area was higher than 15 feet. There was no hill that you could stand on and not see it from. There was no point in the whole area of this land space where you would not have seen this box on the horizon of that land. It would have been noticeable. And people would have said, what on earth is going on over there? Noah brought attention to himself in a significant way. But what was he bringing attention to? It wasn't really himself, was it? Noah had been told by God that God was going to destroy the whole earth. So you can imagine, people were coming to Noah, and they were saying, laughing and jeering at Noah, saying, what on earth are you doing? What are you going to do with a box that size? We only need little boxes to carry things. You're not even going to be able to lift that box. That box is huge. What are you going to do with it? And he turns around to them and he says, oh, God's told me that he's going to destroy you all because of your sin and because of your rejection against him. You can imagine the laughter that they would have had, can't you? Imagine if we said that to somebody outside today, that in 100 years, God is going to destroy the whole earth, and I am building the biggest box anyone has ever seen. You would be laughed at and jeered at. It would be horrendous. And we complain today about what it is like to live as a Christian. Noah faced, must have been the most significant problems at that time. You can imagine how much wood he would have had to glean together. I mean, we can only imagine what size trees they were. But even if we imagine the very largest possible trees, that is a huge ordeal to try and do. To chop down massive trees, to actually bring them, slice them all up, make up this big box, and do it day in, day out for 100 years. So in this time period, his sons are born, they grow up, they marry. We're not told about any other children. We're not told about them having children either. We are just told there are 8 people. So these 8 people are working on building this box. Noah, from the moment his children were born, and they're starting to grow up, and he's teaching them what he is doing, they would have heard what everyone around them was saying. You can imagine, the other children would have been laughing at them. Oh, your dad's building a big box. What a hoot. I know what my dad says about that. And you can imagine the difficulties that they had. And they grew up in this family, and they helped their dad. And their dad told them about what God had said, and the promise that they had to be in that box when the world was to be destroyed. And indeed, whether or not they had a true understanding of faith in God, we're not told. Indeed, there are things that took place later that might bring into question whether they truly had a faith in God like Noah did. But they believed what their father was telling them, and they worked hard in helping him, despite all that was taking place. And they knew that there was only a set time in which they would know whether this was going to happen. God had said when it was going to take place. And so they knew that there was a deadline that was coming. And you can imagine, Noah, I would have thought, was very, very worried. He was concerned about those around him. He could see other believers, and he was thinking, well, why isn't God going to save them? What has God got in mind for them? He's saving me, my wife, my three sons, and their wives. But there's my father, there's my grandfather. There are others who believe in God, and yet he is not doing anything for them. And what we find is that in God's plan, in God's will, that indeed Methuselah and Lamech die within 5 years of when the flood was going to come. They all saw this big box. They all saw that this box was being made. And indeed, you can imagine from their point of view, they knew this promise had been made. And they may have wondered where they would be before God in that. And we find that God brings their deaths before that time. Which means in those last 5 years, Noah and his three sons and their wives were very much alone. They were the last of those who were following God, who were obeying him in all things. And eventually that day comes. And we will look again, as I say, that in more fullness another time. But I want you to think about the fact that that day did come. Noah, his sons, and their wives, they get ready to board that box. And they see that God has brought the animals to them. And they enter that box in faith. They enter that box in faith. They believe that God is going to protect them from whatever calamity he is bringing upon the earth. God has promised them that they will survive, but that he will destroy all else. It would have been a terribly fearful moment at seeing all that was around and seeing that it was all going to be destroyed. But at the same time, they enter this box in faith that God will fulfill his promise, that they will be saved from that judgment. And I want you to think now about what Jesus himself said. And so written in Matthew and Luke. And Jesus said, "But as the days of Noah were, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark, and did not know until the flood came and took them all away. So also will the coming of the Son of Man be." Indeed, as we come now to this week of Easter and we think about what Jesus did on the cross, Jesus himself pointed to what Noah had done all those years previously. And he pointed to that faithfulness Noah had in entering the ark. And he points out the sinfulness of mankind, that the world around continued in the lives that they had chosen. They continued to eat and drink and be merry. They chose to live their lives as they saw fit. They got married, they gave away in marriage, right up to that last moment when the floodwaters came. And then they realized what the judgment of God was. Indeed, Jesus promises us there is a greater judgment yet to come. And there will be the world living around, doing their own thing, living their own lives, doing what they see to be fit, that indeed they will eat and they will drink and they will be merry. They will marry and give away in marriage. And they will be oblivious to the reality that that judgment will come. And yet, Jesus provided a promise. In John chapter 10, verse 9, we read the words, "I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved." Indeed, we are given that picture of an ark. And we are given the picture of Jesus being the door of that ark. And indeed, Jesus says, those who come to me, those who believe in me, those who follow me, those who pray, those who worship, those who do as they are commanded, in faith, as Noah did. It seemed a ridiculous task to Noah, I'm sure. And yet it was quite a simple task, but took 100 years in many respects. And Noah kept to that, day in, day out. He lived his life in obedience to God through faith. That is what made Noah stand out at that time, that he had faith in God. And it is that same faith in Jesus Christ that allows us to enter the new ark, where Jesus is the door, and he promises us that we will be saved. It is a message that we are to take to the nations. We have been given a great commission that we are to declare to the world around us that there is this impending judgment, that they are in disobedience to God. We don't need to pinpoint each individual sin. Even in this passage, God doesn't lay out every single sin for us. What he says is their sin is absolute. Their rejection of him was complete, utterly, throughout their entire lives. The rejection of his word was complete. But the Bible teaches us we have not yet reached that point. And unlike with Noah's Ark, there won't just be 8 people that will be saved. There will be many, many more. God promises that there will be as many as there are the stars, as many as the grains of sand on the beach. And we are commanded to go forth and to share and declare his word to others. We should not be sitting here with our ticket for the ark in quiet anticipation. Like Noah, we are building a big box. We're bringing attention to that judgment. And we are declaring God's grace on mankind. But God will only tolerate man for so long. And he has promised that will come to an end. And only those who are called to him will be provided that grace. Indeed, I hope that we all have the ambition to want to actually declare that we have tickets on that great ark, that indeed they too can grab one for themselves, that all they need to do is to believe in Jesus Christ, to obey him, to follow him in faith, knowing that they too can enter the ark. Indeed, we think upon these things and we turn to our final hymn.